Welcome to the AI Chat Podcast. I'm your host, Jaden Schaefer. Today, we are thrilled to have a true innovator in the tech world with us, Jack McCulley. He is one of the co-founders of Oculus VR, the company that revolutionized virtual reality and was acquired by Facebook for $2 billion. Before that, Jack made significant contributions to the USB standard and is the brains behind the iconic guitar and drums for the Guitar Hero series. His career has consistently bridge the gap between cutting-edge technology and consumer-friendly usability. Welcome to the show today, Jack.
Thank you, Jaden. It's a pleasure to be here. The accolades you just sung on my behalf are thank you. It's not as deserved as you put it, but trying to be humble here. So here's the thing is like I've been doing this for 40 years and this is a vineyard here. There's a winery. This is my place. And I go to the farmer, like I'm trying to school the guy who does the farming here as a contract farmer on, you know, watering and plants. He goes, I've been doing this for 37 years. I don't need you to tell me what to do. but it just comes with time, honestly. And, you know, I have a very high level of education, courtesy of the taxpayers, which has been returned in tenfold or whatever. But it's just my desire as a person who's been involved with art, particularly, you know, video games and movies. Yeah. And I worked on feature films too long ago, but it just happened out that way. I had never had a plan. As a matter of fact, I didn't even have a retirement or anything like that. Never did. It was always equity. I endeavored to find. So, because somebody goes, don't you have a pension? I go, no, don't need one now. But so, and my pension is myself, actually. Uh-huh. So, I teach at UC Berkeley. I'm taking a semester off to run this facility here. This is a research facility that I own, and I'm taking a semester off to do this and help run the vineyard. I'm learning a lot about grape growing, which I didn't even want to do. So,
anyhow, that's a fascinating new project and kind of angle, which I'd love to dive into a little bit. Something though, I did like have a question about is. So, you know, you've done a lot of things in this tech space. I'd be curious, just like going back to the beginning for you, was this always something that you were interested in, like tech specifically? You know, you mentioned you're an artist and I get like this artistic feel from a lot of the work you've done. What was your, I guess, like, you know, prior to education, like what was your goal? Was this always an interest?
I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be a scene designer, a set designer, painting and drawing. That's what I did. I like to take things apart too and draw them. You know, I didn't really understand what they did, but but in the process of doing that, I learned about how things are built and how things work, and so that's just how it started. I love sci-fi stuff, and I spent tons of time drawing. You know, I guess what do they call it? What's the technical term for it? Heroics, which is like Frank Frazetta. You know, guys with spears and robots and all kinds of stuff like that. Like, so it was a natural for me to migrate into entertainment because I couldn't find, you know, in Hollywood where I worked initially, actually I worked in Southern California on films. The pay sucks. It just is not good. And so I said, I gotta make more dough. And cause I wanted cars and stuff like that, nice house, a pool. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up in video games. The pay does not suck in video games, pays really well. Mm-hmm. So I just stayed there, but it was because of the salary, you know, I was making I graduated from college from a prestigious university and making $28,000 a year. Not very good.
Yeah, especially in California.
That was the going rate. I mean, you know, it was, I don't know what it was back then. That's like 18 bucks an hour. So that's what people were getting paid down there in LA. And then transitioning into video games, which I had done before, a little bit before that. I had worked on that stuff also, but just transitioning, it immediately jumped to $100,000 a year.
Wow.
4X increase. I said, I'm going to stay here. and I did. But I had, you know, I had family and stuff to take care of. So it's like, didn't go very far.
100%. Yeah. And I definitely feel that, you know, sometimes people talk about following their passions. And I 100% believe that there's a way to follow your passions while also doing what, you know, takes care of yourself, takes care of your family. Mm-hmm. I did hear that you spent some time working in or doing some nuclear, kind of in the nuclear field in the U.S. Navy. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about sure. your time there and maybe how that influenced you.
I got a job as a tech, electronics technician through the U.S. Navy, and I was successful there as a tech. I can take the stuff apart, right? It's like a no-brainer. Could use hand tools and knew all the spectrum of drills and all this stuff. So it's easy work for me. In the process of doing that, I got a scholarship from the Navy to go to Berkeley. And at the time, we were shorthanded in engineering. Engineers are always in demand. We have to import people from other countries here to fill the void of engineering talent. And it hasn't changed. It was like that in the late 70s. So I got a scholarship. What it was like, it's fun working on submarines. I worked in nuclear engineering. What we did at this base was refueling. We cut a hole in the top of the submarine, and I can't get into too much detail of that, but you replace the fuel that's in a nuclear reactor.
Okay.
So there's all kinds of test reports and stuff that needs to be done. And so I just migrated away from tools to more paperwork stuff. And working with an engineering team, this is a real live engineering team, our nuclear engineers, electrical engineers, the engineering department at the shipyard, wherever. So upon graduating, I didn't want to be there. So I told them, even though I got a thank you for the scholarship, but I'm going to go work something else, do something else. But that's how I migrated away from that very quickly because I didn't really like it. But
okay.
It was a job and paid my bills. And I think, what I was making back then, I think it was like $4 an hour.
Okay.
That's a pretty good wage, $4 an hour. And I could afford a car rent. So, but they paid my tuition and full scholarship. So I got some cash too, but I had to work there. So that what it was like, it wasn't what I wanted to do. I was a young guy and it just seemed like I wasn't creative. Doing paperwork. I didn't mind the tool stuff. That was fun. The paperwork stuff. I didn't want to do that.
So, gotcha. Yeah. And it seems like that's kind of a trajectory I think you followed in, you talk about the fact that you didn't necessarily have this like grand plan for everything you've been doing, but I feel like in the way that you followed your passions and not just because there was an opportunity, right? Like perhaps the nuclear thing had a good scholarship and a good opportunity and whatnot, but you chose to do what, really interested you. And I believe following your creativity and your passion is what's going to make you excel the most at what you do. And then you're able to excel. So you, of course, moved on from this. You talked a little bit about working in Hollywood and then working in video games. Talk to me a little bit about, what got you excited about video games and then ultimately why you decided to, transition away from that.
Well, I never really transitioned away from video games. I don't do that anymore because I don't have a job. But I'm retired. I have a job at teaching and stuff like that. So
right.
Work in environmental engineering, electric vehicles and things like that, which I like. When I mentioned the heroics, that's an art form of art, like Frank Frazetta. I don't know who he is, but he says he's an acrylic painter and he paints these macho guys with spears and Vikings and stuff like that. I just love that stuff. I got a job at Kodak Research as a sequential logic engineer and programmer. So I was programming chipsets and things like that. I could do that too. And writing software, mostly on a Sun workstation. Mm-hmm. And so they go, well, we got some work here on Terminator 2 and Dick Tracy. And are you interested? I go, hell yes. Terminator is a heroic, kind of a thing, macho type thing. Yeah, of course I love that stuff. And so I did that and it was a success and it got an Oscar. No, I didn't get an Oscar, but the system did. ORC produced with Kodak. And I'm thrilled with that, of course. That launched me into other things, honestly, because I always had that on my resume now. Even though I didn't have a resume, I'd say I worked on T2 and Dick Tracy and Edward Scissorhands and these other things. And that got my foot in the door for sure because they want to hear about it. In an interview, if you say something like that, they stop talking about transistors and resistor system, we'll talk about that stuff. So I would say that that relationship I had with my boss at Kodak, who's a great guy, I stayed in touch with the guy for 35 years. He's passed away now. He's an old guy.
Okay.
He's also a PhD. He's a brilliant, absolutely brilliant guy. He got me other gigs too. You know, that's how it works. I get one gig and this guy goes, hey, hire that guy. Mm. He's pretty good. He's kind of a jerk sometimes to hire him anyways. He hired me. And you know, that's kind of the way it went down. And Oculus, right? Same thing. I was at Activision for quite some time. And my guy I worked with there, Greg Deutsch, calls me and says, hey, there's this guy named Brendan Uribe who wants to come show you something. And I go, what is it? And he goes, it's a headset. I go, VR headset. I go, oh no. Okay. So he comes in, knocks on my door, and I just hit it off with the guy. I really like the guy. He's a great guy, you know. And so that's how it was. It's like, the product was good. It was cool, but I like the people. Like, if I'm going to work with something and we're going to work 12 or 13 hours in the trenches, which is what it is. It's kind of like long, long, long hours.
Yeah.
I got to get along with the people. If there's any hint that that won't happen, I won't take the work.
And, yeah.
So that's how that Oculus kind of went down, was because of the relationships I had throughout my career. And these things, I ended up working on game controllers and reverse engineering video game, PlayStation, PS1 controllers, all kinds of controllers. I ended up reverse engineering those. This gets me my foot in the door. And I built a mouse, a special mouse. So this gets my foot in the door at Logitech, working on USB. Uh-huh. And so that's how it went down. Just it was a building process. And I was pretty careful about what I chose, sometimes not so careful. Uh-huh. One of your questions today will be about one of those choices, but generally I'm pretty careful who I work with. And if there's any hint of politics or anything like that, I'm out of there. I'll split. I'll finish my work, but I'm not going to put up with, you know, a bunch of petty stuff like that. I run into that. It just comes with the territory, the two-legged,
for sure.
You know, that's just the way it is. I stayed in tech side of stuff mostly, except at Oculus and other places. I was doing more managerial stuff, but I tried to stay in the tech stuff because I have less exposure to politics and backbiting and vindictiveness and other things that I can't stand. I just stay away from that stuff. And so it kind of went down that way, just references. I never really had a resume. If they ask me for one, I say, I don't have one. Call this guy and then call him. I don't know. You know, things are a little bit more formal with HR now. Not back then. I mean, it's just like, you know, we'll try you out. If you don't work, work out, we'll get ready.
So right.
Pretty much, you know, do or die kind of thing. So back now I think it's, you know, with lawyers and stuff, it's kind of a little bit more, it's a little tough, you know, tougher now to do that. But so that's the way it went down.
That's so interesting. So obviously I think that's an incredible way to kind of go through your career. I think like not having a resume, just like kind of going off of reference and people, like ultimately at the end of the day, that's what a company wants. I really feel like it should be a little bit more like that today, where sometimes people get hired exclusively for, you know, the resume and maybe the prestigious school they went to, but it's not like project based. Like, what did you actually do? What did you actually accomplish?
Exactly.
Like, and like at the end of the day, especially for startups, it's like they need people that have actually done a thing that they can then carry forward into what they're doing. So, were you working at Activision before, like on the, were you working on that USB before you were doing the Guitar Hero stuff?
The USB stuff started in 1993. Okay. And I was living in Oakland, California at the time and working as a consultant with Logitech.
Okay.
Some hardware engineer as a consultant. That started in 93. There was no USB because I knew the BIOS, without getting into too much detail, the BIOS is the low level boot stuff on a PC. Causes it to boot. I knew the BIOS very well and the software structure of it. Primarily got hired for that because I could write drivers and things like this.
Okay.
I'm a hardware engineer kind of guy, mixture of things. So that's how I got hired. Now, Guitar Hero came much later. That came in 2005. And by that time, I had built up a pretty good skill set. And the bottom line, Jaden, is speed. You have to get it done fast, blazing speed. And if it's okay to be slow, I mean, and thorough, that's also good. But when you're trying to get something out the door and get funding and money from investors, speed and a good demo. So I had that, and I had a vast knowledge base of various consoles and PCs and stuff like this because I'm interested in it and I like video games. So I had all this stuff in place. By the time Guitar Hero recruited me, I'm not a founder of Guitar Hero. It's a really interesting story. It would be a great book because the two guys that started the company, they're the founders, brothers, they had a video game rental business.
And
what they did is they wanted to make a DDR, Dance Dance Revolution dance pad that came out in 99, Konami Entertainment in Japan. It's a dancing game, the rhythm game. So the music plays and you step on switches on a flat pad and you can dance, right? The guy's got those videos on YouTube. The guys are really fast at it.
I'm not super fast at it, but you know, I've definitely done it.
they endeavored to write their own rhythm game without doing a lot of research into intellectual property. Come to find out, we got sued. They hired me to work on their dance pad. I fixed some problems with it, basic, really simple stuff. But based on my ability to work, the kind of work they needed, they hired me. Okay, this is prior to Guitar Hero. Then another guy shows up who they hired as the CEO, which was a really, really smart move. If you don't know how to do something and let your ego go and hire someone who's better than you, that's what you do. They hired this guy, Kelly Sumner, who's a former CEO of Take-Two, which is GT Grand Theft Auto. This guy comes in, he bundles the company up into a package. They start working on a demo game of Guitar Hero using the same game engine from Harmonix Music that they use for the dance pad. It's just porting it over to a plastic guitar. The plastic guitars we used were from a Japanese game called Guitar Freaks. So the demo unit that I saw initially at CES in 2005 was a Guitar Freaks guitars and Harmonix Music's port of the dance game that they had written. And this was the basis of Guitar Hero. And Kelly's job was to find, my job was to engineer. I engineered, built the stuff. It's like, honestly, it was pretty easy. I mean, I got a lot of accolades for it, but it's really pretty simple stuff. And I already knew how to do it. It wouldn't be simple if you try to teach a layman how to do it. But for me, I already been doing that stuff for a long time. So anyhow, I saw this at CES and I was like, I didn't think much of it. I'm like, okay, you've got costs of goods, you've got hardware, and you're going to bundle this up with a piece of software and sell it. And we have production issues. Like, who is going to build this for us? Like, it's a challenge. And the initial versions of that were built by a company called Honeybee in China and migrated out of Honeybee into vast number of contract manufacturers. Here's a great story. This is a contract manufacturer located in China, and they're a big contract manufacturer. We go there and I look at the place, it's huge. I'm going, and this is Guitar Hero 3, right? I'm looking around and I'm going, so I said, where are we doing our stuff? And I looked out the window and there's this huge building. And I go, it's the size of a football stadium. That was our production facility.
Wow.
And then I was scared. It's like, if I F this up, if I screw up, this is big. I had no idea, but it was a smash hit. And it surprised me. I'm not particularly good at choosing hits and stuff I like, I like Gran Turismo and driving cockpit games. I like that kind of stuff. It's perfect for Oculus. You know?
Yeah.
Rhythm games, not my thing, but it was a smash hit. Now the guy, Kelly Sumner, packaged up the business and pitched it to a bunch of companies, including Electronic Arts. Nobody wanted it. Can you imagine Electronic Arts turning that down?
Right.
We already had the ability to build the plastic, a little tiny
company.
Was
this pre-launch or post-launch? Like after is a huge hit or before?
After. Guitar Hero launched, it was selling really well, yeah. And we had to find a partner. And so EA was pitched to EA and then pitched, because we pitched, we were actually producing and getting this stuff sold and stuff. We didn't have distribution. We didn't have marketing. We didn't have that stuff. It's a small company. There's mm-hmm. two brothers and me and about 25 other people. That was it.
Okay.
So we found the partners. We found Activision. We had angel investors, people who were private citizens who invest money, maybe a friend or an uncle or something like that. Mm-hmm. We didn't have big investment. And I don't think that those two brothers had big cash. They do now, had big right. cash. So we were strapped with finding someone to fund it. And thankfully Activision saw what it was and was able to see through a lot of the problems, like production problems and okay. cost of goods and all of that, and put it in the market, and mostly the distribution and marketing. It was everywhere. It was commercials on TV and everywhere. That's all them. That's their horsepower, right? It's mm-hmm. the marketing part of it.
Yeah.
And so Guitar Hero 1 and Guitar Hero 2 sold well. Guitar Hero 3 did exponentially better. The total number of units is 64 million.
Oh my gosh.
It was the first video game franchise to hit 2 billion in sales. 2 billion.
Wow.
This is 18 years ago.
Yeah.
So it was the first one. And by then it had grown, you know, and outgrown me. And, you know, it's a huge company. Activision's not I'm not saying it's a huge company, but it's bigger than Red Octane, which is the two brothers company. Mm-hmm. By that time it had grown so big, and it's beyond me to do, you know, that's like me running Apple computers, you know, company. I could
right.
beyond that. So I focused on the inventing part and intellectual property, and back to the Oculus story. This is how I met Greg Deutsch, who turned me on to Brendan. So I was okay. working in the intellectual property department doing patents. I'm an inventor, so I do patents and stuff. And I know that world pretty well. So that's kind of how it went down. When it got big like that, as I mentioned previously, I kind of looked around and said, it's a, you know, not what I really want to do.
Okay.
And I ended up getting out of there and taking a break for about 2 years. I didn't work. Really, I just did hobby stuff, you know.
Had you made like a decent amount from the company growing very big? Like,
oh, yeah.
Did you have like, yeah. did you have equity in it, or was it just like, you know, your salary?
I had both.
Okay.
So this is what I did. I had a relationship with a semiconductor provider. Mm-hmm. I sold pre-programmed chips, is what my main business was. This goes back a long time, into the 90s. I would get a chip, and I'd call it the PlayStation chip. Mm-hmm. And it could run a PlayStation controller. It was completely debugged. It looked exactly like Sony's PlayStation mm-hmm. controller chipset, PS1. That's what I did. I sold those. And I sold them to Mad Catz and PDP and Thrustmaster all over Europe. And so every time I sold one, they bought it direct from the semiconductor company. And mm-hmm. the commission was paid to me by the semiconductor company. So they just placed an order. I got a commission check.
Okay. Well,
so... when Guitar Hero came along, it's the same thing. It's like, I'll give you the chip. You know, the pay sucked, quite frankly. I was getting paid $60,000 or something like that. I didn't okay. care about that. All I care about is selling the chip, right?
Okay.
And all of a sudden, I'm getting these huge checks in. You know, like, I'm talking.
Because as the product is going crazy, you're getting all of the exactly. royalties off of the chips. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, okay. It is, but... Activision view of that is that you're eating into our bottom line.
Right.
You know, that's how they see it. And it's kind of right. It is. That is true. You know, uh-huh. I am eating into the bottom line, but they knew about it. You know, I told you, uh-huh. I get a commission. So that's how I made money. I also got stock options. I got a nice, generous stock option from Activision. When the company was acquired, it was the key person, one of the key people there that was in the acquisition. It got me, and they got Charles and Kai, the two brothers, and mm-hmm. Lee, and some other folks that are working there. So, and so that's the way the acquisition was written up. Now, you know what they paid for Guitar Hero? It's like $120 million. Now you hear about the Oculus's $3.2 billion acquisition, and they paid $120 million for Guitar Hero. It was an enormous hit. So,
wow,
yeah, that's not much, right?
Uh-huh, and
now these days it's not much. Back then it was pretty good. So you know, the two brothers wisely invested their earnings on that, and I'm sure they're doing really well on those guys. But Charles is the younger of the two, Charles and Kai. Charles got me a trustee gig at Berkeley. He's also a fellow at UC Berkeley, as is
those cool.
guys, or alumni.
You guys still friends to this day?
I would say, you know, when you work with someone and it's stressful, they don't call it friendsness. They're not right. your friends. Your friends right. are away from work and your buddies, you know?
Yeah.
But when you're not working with them, you can be friendly with them. I would put it this, the current state of our relationship as friendly. And I know his wife, Charles's wife, Lillian. Kai is a little bit more quiet and reserved than Charles. Charles is boisterous. And so Charles is a good guy. He really is. I mean, look what they did for me. I mean, how can I criticize them? They were always generous with me. They're very generous people. I would say that was the case. Mm-hmm. You know, just didn't think about trying to help people out, you know. And I remember also that it's like they were driving their mom's car. They're young guys, right? It's like, I'm not sure that's exactly true, but he's driving a gray Mercedes, and it's like turns out to be his mom's. But they all kind of live in that same area. They live up in Los Gatos now.
Okay.
That area, but they're good guys. And I have to say, every time I pulled out of one of those things, I kept to maintain the relationship. I call people, mm-hmm. not so much Oculus guys, but because I'm not working anymore, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
No one's going to hire me now. I mean, I could, but I'm not looking for a job. Mm-hmm. But I always call people, like call them and say, hey man, how you doing? What are you guys working on? You know, or something like that. They won't tell uh-huh. you sometimes, but you know, I'll tell you, this is what I'm working on, that kind of stuff. Or let's go get lunch, go meet them for lunch, you know? And that pays off in spades because, you know, whatever difficulties you had at working with someone could kind of get softened a little bit.
Right. So right.
I would say, in terms of Oculus, it was a good experience for me. The product, I said publicly in 2019, it's not going anywhere, was kind of right. But I'd say that every time. Uh-huh. But it was kind of right in some ways. It has not, mostly because, you know, Facebook, Meta, right, is a social media company, advertising company. Uh-huh. They sell ads, right? They're not a video game company. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me the proper thing to do would be to buy a big studio mm-hmm. and have them work on the game and stay out of the way. Mm. But that's not the way it went down, apparently. Mm-hmm. And it was very dictatorial and top-down driven, which doesn't work. I tell you this, you work at a studio, there's really creative people there, and mm-hmm. you just got to get out of the way. You know, mm-hmm. you may not like what they're doing, but you just got to let it go and not say anything. Mm-hmm. That's what I learned. And if you do that, it works much better. And that's not what happened with Horizon Worlds and Meta. It was just a kind of a personal thing, I guess.
When you'd gotten started with Meta, so, you know, you took a break after Guitar Hero for a little bit. You know, then you had someone come in and show you the Oculus. When you gotten started, was it kind of that like small studio vibe? Like what kind of attracted you to actually, you know, working with them?
Yeah. Well, they didn't have a office when they first started. It was probably Brennan's house, and we didn't have an office. Those guys working, I think Palmer was living in a trailer out in front of his house. That's what I heard. I don't know if that's true. And Nate Mitchell was working for Autodesk. He wasn't even there until later, showed up till later. So it was very small. And quite frankly, they relied on me. They were relying on me to produce. See, they had a Kickstarter. I don't know what that is.
But yeah.
A crowdfunded thing. And you just did it to get attention mm-hmm. to the product. And they did Nate and Brendan, mostly Nate, did a really beautiful job on it. It was like professionally done. We had a movie crew in. It was filmed not here, another place I had. You filmed it. They had a movie crew in, out, all this stuff. And then when I saw it, I go, oh my God, that's really, really good. And it got a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. And they built the story, Palmer Luckey story, based on Oculus. It's a great story. It's an 18-year-old guy, and he's built this thing in his garage and how fantastic it is. Mm-hmm. And that was the whole thing. So you're asking me about the size of the place. Now, if we had proceeded forward with the core team, Mike, mm-hmm. Nate, and some other folks there, myself, Brennan, Palmer, and tried to sell that to a Facebook, What would you do if you walked into, you know, like a dusty shop garage and you saw those people sitting there? It's not impressive.
Right. Yeah.
So there was a lot of hiring done, key people. Some people really, really high-end developers and so forth. We hired really great people. John Carmack and other folks hired. And this gave the impression that we were serious. And we decorated, we rented at least two floors of a high-rise in Orange County. And we set up the office. It looked like a game studio, you know, with figurines and graffiti and stuff. I like that stuff too.
Yeah, yeah.
So it looked like a dev studio. So when you walk in there, let's say you're, I don't know, a guy that runs a social media company called Meta, and you see that, you know they're serious.
Yeah.
And if you're not in the video game world, first thing I want to see, let me see your demo. Let's see your stuff, right?
Yeah.
That's the worst thing I want. I don't care about other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we had to have this presentation in order to get someone to be interested in buying the company, because without that, they're just going to see five dorks in a garage, you know, kind of like deal. And it's just, and so again, that's not what I do. I'm the tech guy, the technical guy in production. It's like I can make stuff. But I think that was what really carried it forward and got people to believe. It's a great experience. You put it on and the visual part of it is very, very good. There's some problems, you know, Jaden, with VR, and primarily because motion sickness is a big one, and no one's conquered that. I endeavored to try to fix it on my own. I couldn't fix it. Without, you know, I would need a team. It was me and some other people working on that, but it's just, it's challenged with that. It is, it's the frontier, that needs to be tackled by, young people, in a separated studio away from, headquarters.
Yeah.
And this is how Activision is set up, by the way.
Really?
You go to the office, it's just a little, it's a building, it's a nice building and stuff. There's not that many people there. It's not that, it's not big. But
okay.
The studios, Neversoft, and so on, are set up as separate entities, and the Activision people do not go there. They're a separate thing. It's an artistic endeavor. That's what it is. So that's the successful model. There's different models. EA, I worked at EA also, EA Sports. It's kind of centralized like that. Their mocap studio is right on campus in Burnaby, Canada, and so forth. So EA is kind of set up like that. EA Sports, I'm talking about the studio. More centralized, but for the most part, the most successful model is separated model, where you let people work creatively.
Yeah, that makes 100%. That makes so much sense, because I feel like there's so many incredible ways for companies and for like capitalism, right, whatever, to capitalize on creativity and art, like video games and all sorts of different things. But so often, like you said, right, if you try to stick this into a headquarters, like that's not where creative people thrive. And if you want them to do their best work, aka, you know, what the consumer will like the most, what will make the company the most successful, like you have to set up the environment for them to be able to thrive there. When Facebook was, you know, interested in Oculus, had you'd already kind of created the headset? Had it launched, the first one? Talk me through the timeline of what was going on and what you're working on there.
Sure. So we launched a Kickstarter, and we gave, so the way Kickstarter
So you came on pre-Kickstarter?
Yeah, I was there.
Okay.
They filmed the Kickstarter video at my other place. I
know okay.
The book read that. Yeah, they filmed it at my other studio. So I didn't have a studio. I had one.
Okay.
So R&D center or whatever.
Yeah.
So they came in and they filmed the Kickstarter video. It went up and we had 90 days to get it finished. This is the first developer kit. And that is just a staggering short period of time. So I took Palmer's prototype to China and we reversed. Palmer got the lenses on eBay for the DK1. Those were on eBay. He got those on eBay. We didn't have any specs on anything. And we got other parts from other people, like Mark Bolas at USC gave us some stuff and Reality Labs. But essentially, it was dead cold. The strap was from Scott Goggles, you know, like ski goggles. That's where it came from. So we cobbled that together and took that over there and had them source the parts and do the tooling. Incidentally, the woman that owns the factory is a very close friend of mine. And she got the Guitar Hero stuff. That was a huge break for her.
Okay.
Before that, she was doing little game controllers and stuff. She got this huge contract. So she owed me, but I took it in there. I go, this is, I had to sell it, right? She's like, uh-huh. This is going to change the world, blah, blah, blah. She looked at it. She goes, okay, let me see. And she took off. She goes, how much money you guys got? I go, not much. She goes, okay, you have to give me half up front. And well, I can make 10,000 of them, but you got to pay me. So we had to scrounge up 750K or something like that, almost a mil. And that kind of the way it went down is very informal, not mm-hmm. like contract signing, lawyers and all that. We didn't do that. We just like kind of hacked our way in. And I like that, by the way. But it didn't go down like that. So DK1, to answer your question, comes along and launches and it sells through like 10,000, uh-huh. gone. We made more. Sells through. Suddenly we're like it's a small run. It's not very tiny, but uh-huh. we're like 70,000 units and it's still being bought with a subpar sort of performance. It's just a couple people's prototype thing that we reproduced in plastic. Essentially that's uh-huh. what we did. And it was selling really well. And the buzz that it was starting to show up on TV on, uh-huh. on Jimmy Kimmel and all this sort of stuff. And that's Brennan, but and so we kind of realized that they might be onto something. Uh-huh. And at least the talent and skill that certain people have, like my boss for marketing and getting stuff into people. So he's so good at that. He's a really talented guy. He's also a software engineer. He doesn't do that though. He's, he's a showman,
Okay. Kind of gotcha. Yeah.
So he sold 70,000. And then, so what are we going to do? Well, Vive. We have a competitor now in Washington, right? And we had been working with those guys and they have a room experience unit, right? Uh-huh. What you can walk around in, which is ultimately what you want.
Yeah.
We had a room experience prototype at Oculus and we got that from Valve mostly, but we already had kind of had that, but we chose a seated experience for cockpit games, but we had to eliminate some vestibular motion sickness issues.
Right.
We used a camera and LEDs on the inside of the headset that you can't see that are like markers that you can monitor the position of the head and so forth and get translations from side to side. With DK1, those kinds of translations aren't handled. They can't be. The technology doesn't exist at DK1 to handle those. But a camera looking at it from the outside, an observer can do that.
Okay.
So we came out with a DK2, and DK2 sold 150,000. Like, boom, right?
Okay.
So the timeline is DK1, and now we have people's attention, and mm-hmm. Mark Zuckerberg is interested, and Mark Zuckerberg shows up at the office in Irvine in Orange County, the two stories of a high rise thing, and the sales pitch was on. He was like, Brennan can could sell you moon dust, even though he's not moon dust. Sold the guy. he sold it to him, and the rest is kind of history. It was on Silicon Valley. They were skewering it. It was, and when you're getting skewered on a comedy show, you've had an impact. And that's great.
Yeah.
So that, and at the same time, I'm like looking at this and going, where are we going with this? And then I'm looking at, we're going to get acquired by Meta. I think that's what's going to happen here. This right, mm-hmm. I knew what was happening, right? And I was in China. This is a funny story. Brennan calls me. It's like 4 o'clock in the morning. And he goes, hello. I have my iPhone 2 or whatever it was. He goes, guess what? I go, what? I said, you woke me up. He goes, we sold the business to Facebook. And he goes, this is something like, you have a stack of dollar bills going to the moon or something like that. I don't remember exactly what he said. So I said, okay. So I hung up, called my wife, and I told her, well, what do I do?
Yeah.
And she goes, she didn't say this. Another friend of mine said, do you think you fit in at Facebook? And I go, no. I like to work at a studio. I mean, I like art. Uh-huh. That's where I want to be. I don't want to be, moderating people's silly Facebook posts or whatever. I don't think I'd do that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like a language cop or mood cop. So I decided that I would look at my exit pretty quickly after that. Uh-huh. And I went to Brennan and I go, hey man, I don't want to work there. And I don't want to work at Facebook. I said, what would happen to me? I'd probably get fired. I'd say something. I probably would. No, I would get fired. But I would probably say something or do something, and be unhappy.
Yeah.
I don't want to be unhappy. So, and he goes, okay, well, let me talk to him. And he comes back to me. He goes, okay, you can leave. I was like, with your money. Now, most deals like this, you have to stay there for 5 years.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's risky because if you get fired, that's your competition. You could lose a portion of that. And so I looked at that and I go, well, if I go there and they fire me, I could lose. Why don't I just take it all now? That's kind of what I was thinking at the time. And so he granted me that. And the rest, I bet that's 8 years ago or something. And 10 years ago since we formed the company, coming up on 11. Mm-hmm. And 8 years, is that true? 8 years since exit. Yeah, I exited in 2015. You know, when you go to, I go to Facebook and I look around the building three, and there's like beanbag chairs on the floor and a desk that you sit across from. So it's just, I don't like that. I mean, I got to look at the guy all day long and I lay around on the beanbag chairs, you know, an old man. And I didn't see anyone there that was older than me. I would be the oldest person. Maybe the cook. There was a guy in the cafeteria that was like the chef. He's cooking their, you know, vegan specials or whatever. And he was about my age. I go, man, it's just, I won't fit in here. I can tell, you know, it's just, and what would they do with me? You know, I don't know what they would use me for. You know, they need a hardware engineer. But, you know, I will say this, the Quest was a fantastic piece of hardware. They did a really good job on that. And it took a long time, but it's really, really good now. Mm-hmm. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect, but for $350, it's pretty good.
I know that price point is hard to beat. Yeah, and I mean, looking at like what we're seeing with Apple coming into the space, do you feel like that's validating to the idea? What, like, I would just love, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but like from your view of the past, like, how do you think Apple's new headset's going to play into this pricing and all that, you know?
Well, I know the people who are running the headset program at Apple. The guy that's running it is entirely competent and a really, really good engineer. He's the VP level guy. I know him really pretty well. They tried to hire me or recruit me, but I think the problem I faced at Facebook would be the same problem I'd face at Apple. It's just not for me. So, I think it's great. I think it's expensive. It costs as much as a car. And then, you know, in Mexico, I live there a little bit. I got a house there. The wages are low. But people have a mobile phone. I'm looking at it going, so the phone's $400 and you make $2,600 a year. You go, how does that work? That's like, that's an expensive item. Well, they have a payment plan.
Right.
And you pay for the hardware as part of your monthly payments and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it kind of works. They can make it work. You know, they have to hold onto the phone for a long time. But the utility of a phone is obvious. I mean, you need one.
Yeah.
Do you need a VR headset at the same sort of utility level that you need a phone? I would say no. VR headsets are for entertainment. Now, granted, the phone is for entertainment too, but I would say that they're going to be challenged. Now, Apple has got the GDP of Mexico almost. I think that's true. Now, I know, don't quote me on that. It's the company is $3 trillion company. Can they afford to have one fail? Yeah, sure. You know, big deal. Try again. Try something else. But whatever they do really well. I think, in my view, their stuff. I'm not an Apple PC guy. I don't like their computers, but their phones are great. I don't like Android. I like Apple. So it's my preference. Whatever they do well, and it's high quality and it works. I mean, how many times, ask yourself, if you have an Apple, how many times does it reboot or crash? Almost never.
Yeah, and that's true.
Myriad of applications that they didn't write running.
Yeah.
It's a testament to the quality of the engineering that went into it. And they've always had a good engineering there. So, but they can afford to take a hit. Can a smaller company afford that kind of a hit? No. Let me tell you what I think. If we hadn't been acquired by Facebook, we would have failed. The company would have folded
because really?
The cost of goods. We didn't have an application for it. We didn't have any games. Then had a couple small things, demo games and stuff like that. But we didn't.
So what were people using it for? Like those early, you know, ones they were buying.
Well, we had developers. People were writing content around it. Okay. So we got some of those, right? The DK1 is Developer Kit 1 and Developer Kit 2, CV1, Consumer Version 1, so forth. So we had developers that were developing content around it, but there was no major application for it. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, when I got the Quest, when I first got the Quest and put it on, I didn't know. I thought the games were kind of a dud.
Okay.
You know, they're kind of weird.
Yeah.
There was like a disco you went into. I mean, what are you supposed to do? What's the strategy? Your game's got to have strategy.
Yeah.
Got to have. There's got to be a social component. This is the new part of gaming. Like, you're playing against people all over the world. But right. What's the goal? What goals do you have? Is it to conquer the hill, the fort on the hill? Or what are you trying to do? Or shoot the tanks?
Right.
There's no goal, and I just didn't get it. And you have Beat Saber. I mean, it's an arcade-ish game, and you can play that for 20 minutes, but they don't have a long-term play application. I love the idea of the metaverse. I think that's a really cool idea. You can have your own currency.
Yeah.
Roblox, you know what I mean? You can have your own currency. It's a land you can go visit, and you can have a your own lifestyle. You could be better looking than you are. You can have Ferraris, all that stuff. You have to earn them. I think it's a great idea, but the execution, because Facebook is not, Meta is not a video game company, didn't happen.
Yeah.
And had they farmed their stuff out to a dynamic studio, bought a studio and gotten the hell out of the way, it would have had probably a different outcome. They needed a killer game with it and a creative game. So they didn't have that. And how much visual stuff can you do? Okay, the spaceship blew up, and you know, Star Wars, the guy falls out of the spaceship, and so much of that you can, it's like, okay, it's great visuals, but what do I do now? So that's my take on it.
One other thing on that, what do you think, so it's busy, like pretty commented on when Apple kind of launched their VR headset. Yeah, the thing looks super high end, super high quality. Mm-hmm. Apple makes great things, so they have that reputation, but it was noted that they didn't mention like games at all in their headset launch. So do you think that's gonna hold them back? Like, isn't that a big part of adoption of these VR headsets?
What is Apple's Apple sells entertainment. They have iTunes, and now they're starting to get into feature films. They're getting into content for their hardware. If they could come up with a game or content for it, I don't know what that would be. One of the really good ideas I heard, and this was attempted, is like if you wanted to go to a sports venue and you want to sit on like a Jets game or something like that, or like Niners, and sit on the 50-yard line, you could sell that ticket to 100 people and have them put the headset on and watch the game right there with people right next to you, real people. And people are working on this, with 360 cameras and so forth. They were thinking about this. I think that's a great, I would like to do that. I'd like to go to a Niners game or Jets or something. Patriots and sit on the 50-yard line. That's great. And pay $20 or $50 or something to watch 3 hours of football.
Yeah,
that's something that I would enjoy and do. So this is the thing, is like they just haven't, no one has had the ability to come up with a mechanism or entertainment part for a headset. They just haven't been able to do that so far, and this is what's probably holding it back. Mm-hmm. You know, granted there are vestibular issues also, so this is why a game where you walk around and you're wearing the headset doesn't really work very well. That's one of the main ones, is it makes people sick.
And yeah,
I don't get sick from it. I've been staring at computer screens for 40 years, but a lot of people who don't do that put it on and they go, I don't feel well, I feel dizzy. Mm-hmm. You know, so anyways, that's my call. And Apple's ability to execute is well known. Their stuff's flawless. And let me ask you a question. You know, the Apple has an app for the car, right? Apple Car. Why aren't car manufacturers using that? I mean, there's cars everywhere. There are some using it. You know, I have a car with it in it, but they want to sell their own. They want their own content. And their own software. And I think. Heard an interview with Ford Motor Company. They said, we don't provide hardly any of the software for our cars. It's all third party stuff. Mm-hmm. It seems to me you'd want to bring that in and put content in the vehicle. Tesla's pretty much done that successfully. They have games and stuff you can put in. So this is the issue really, is that there's not really good content for VR right now. You heard some of my ideas here.
Yeah.
But watching a movie at a movie theater sounds good. But why aren't we doing that? It's if it could bring in revenue, people would be doing it, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Quest sold 20 million headsets. This is what they quoted.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's a lot of them.
Yeah, actually, no, a ton of people, especially with the cheaper version. I don't know if the Pro did quite as well. Yeah. I heard they kept cutting the price and handing it out at the end. So that's why I'm concerned about Apple, just because it seems like that price point that might make it a little bit tricky. Question for you kind of on the overall landscape in tech right now, based off of, you know, what you've seen in the past and today. I feel like we've seen a couple different waves over the last number of years. We've seen kind of, there was like the Web3 crypto wave. There is this whole metaverse wave. Different levels of those things have kind of sputtered out or changed. Mm-hmm. Today, of course, we're seeing the AI wave where everyone's integrating AI. How would you compare what we're seeing in AI today to some of these previous kind of like big, some people call them bubbles or waves or whatever, but kind of revolutions in tech?
I will say that no one's quite clearly explained what AI does. They know that they can go onto a website and ask it to write a song or tell a story, but no one's been able to explain exactly what it is or what it does. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of it's fear. People are afraid of it. Well, what if it starts interfering with social things? And it may be already, but you know, this is the kind of stuff that people are concerned about. Politics, you know, people using it for nefarious purposes. Mm-hmm. Generating stories that aren't true and repeating them in the media over and over again until they become true. This is what people are afraid of. Can it be, if you see Midjourney, I don't know if you've looked at the art and stuff. Yeah. Some of that stuff that is just like, it's like hellish to look at. It's like a nightmare. And some of it's beautiful.
Totally.
The automobile renders and things that have been done with it are just stunning. So it has two purposes. There's two spectrums. One is very negative things it can do, and also very positive things it can do. I don't believe personally that trying to regulate it, if governments try to regulate it, they're going to regulate it in a way which benefits them, not the populace. And
for
this is
sure.
kind of what, yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think its government needs to get involved in that. It has to be self-regulated. You know, there has to be some way of self-regulating. So I'm not sure how that would play out exactly, but there has to be some mechanism for doing that, and that would have to be intrinsic in the provider of the service. Mm-hmm. I think Microsoft has Azure One. I think it is a supercomputer they built. That's the backbone of a lot of the current apps that are out there, which utilize AI are using Microsoft stuff. I mean, basically, it comes out of the cloud, and so. You know, I typed in my name one day to see what it said about me. It was like, most of it wasn't true. It was weird. So can it be curated to lie about things? I think it can be. And then, so what I did was I injected false information into a Wikipedia page and then ran it again. Now it's giving me the stuff from the Wikipedia page. So it looks like it goes to Reddit and Wikipedia to get its stuff. So. There's a guy, Wolfram, that did a really good write-up on the API used for the most popular AI interfaces, and he did a really good job of writing it up and explaining it. And I recommend people to go there. So.
Okay. Very interesting. I would also be curious to hear your thoughts on, you know. So of course we're implementing AI. Do you feel like this is a little bit more perhaps? Like hype around AI? Do you think that it's as impactful as perhaps we're being told? Do you feel like it is less impactful or more? Like, for example, we have people like, you know, Sam Altman saying we're going to start doing universal basic income soon because AI is going to essentially replace most jobs. Do you see that being the case in the future?
I think if you're a writer or an actor, that would be something you'd need to worry about. I don't know how AI would replace a person who does podcasts. Perhaps it could. I mean, to be honest with you, you're very good at this. I've been through a couple podcasts and you obviously have a talent for it.
I appreciate it.
There's things it can't do. Can it treat people's medical conditions? Maybe symptomatically it could, but it can't do surgery. Right? Mm-hmm. No, I mean, you can't do that. Although they have the surgery robots and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It can't drive a Formula One car very well. So a lot of things it can't do. Can it write scripts? Can it write jokes? It can do that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's kind of, this, yeah. Can it write songs? Yes, it can write. I used an AI app I mentioned, but to write a song just to see if it could write. It was pretty good. It was a country western song.
Really?
So, yeah. You just put, write a song about a puppy and it'll write the song about a puppy. So country western. And so it can do that kind of stuff. I think you're onto something there. I don't know that a universal basic income is the answer. You think you just have to reskill yourself. Can AI be a roofer or a plumber? Can't. Can AI fix your car? No. Can't take an engine apart in your car. Can it frame a home? It can't do that. Maybe those will be the high-end jobs, you know? Labor, you know? Can't really do labor. It can do intellectual stuff, probably some stuff, but it can't do certain things. And now anyway, so.
So, okay. So, I want to dive a little deeper on that. So for example, for the podcast, I actually, prior to starting this podcast, actually made probably like 10 podcasts, which were completely written by and spoken by AI, and they became incredibly popular. But I also realized that those podcasts had a hard time converting listeners to like followers. And so when I started this podcast, of course I had that background and I'm like, oh, maybe I'll do an AI podcast and just like make a clone of my voice and then use that. But I came to the conclusion that you actually need like a physical person that makes mistakes, sure, that says, that messes up. Like as AI becomes more prevalent and like everywhere, people aren't going to want to listen to what is like a perfect, like they want mistakes. They want like a little human error in it. So anyways, that's with the podcast thing. But my question on like plumbers and roofers, this is something that I'm like a little concerned about. So Tesla right now, of course, they're making their Tesla humanoid robot. There's others. What if like, do you see like that as a viable solution or option in the future where like, let's say there's a Tesla humanoid robot that eventually is trained on AI, so it's as fluid as a human. Then it just like, you know, you get maybe like an electrician or a plumber to wear like a full body suit for like a year while they're doing all their electrical and plumbing work. That's all like being trained into a model that now plugs into like this humanoid robot. Could we not replace, like, would it not come for blue collar if you're pairing it with like the robot side of things?
Well, most cars in most car factories, even the Teslas, are built robotically. There's the assembly and so forth, not everything, but that replaced human beings. And to replace union workers, you know, high paid union jobs. So, I suppose that could be the case, but there's so much like decision-making and that you need to do when you're doing a repair, like, oh, you look down and there's the floor's rotting below. Oh, I have to go to Home Depot and buy, you know, parts from Home Depot to fix that, whatever. But there's just so much decision-making and expertise level. And it's really hard to, I mean, you can get some expertise stuff in AI, I suppose, but just knowledge, just experience is just not there. And so I think it writes a great country western song, maybe, but can it change the light bulbs by looking up at it, knowing which ones are bad? I don't think so right now. But right, if I were a script writer or someone in Hollywood, I would be concerned about it. You could create an actor who doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Not a real person.
You know? Yeah.
And so good.
So good. It's uncanny.
And just sit there and tune it until you get it to do what you want it to do. You know, you could examine an actor's face and see how it behaves. And so, there's certain areas I think that it could, you know, in warfare also being able to, here's the thing, this is a great, just let me digress a little bit, talk about warfare, because it's something that I've thought about, you know. Right now, you can have a drone go in and do an attack. Right.
Yeah.
And 30 or 40 years ago, you would have to have a person go do that.
Yeah.
The commander, who's a human being, would have to say, Sergeant, take three of your guys out there and then destroy that, whatever it is, pillbox, let's say. But what's running through your mind is the commander's like, I might get these guys killed. I mean, they could die. Well, how am I going to feel about that? Right.
Yeah.
He's a human being. Of course, he's going to feel bad. With a drone, you're not thinking about that. You're just going to attack.
Yeah.
So it brings a whole another level of danger in warfare, of escalating it, because you're not risking people. You're risking a piece of hardware.
Yeah.
So where am I going with this? I think that, you know, in terms of AI, we have similar types of issues like that. I mean, a nefarious person could construct a political dialogue or something like that, because it's just a robot doing it.
Yeah. And
by your example, doing the interview with a, with an AI, Jaden Schaefer, you know, would be, you know, I mean, you're not really risking anything. You're risking something for yourself, but you could have where I'm going with that is just like it removes a human factor. Decision-making is based on, and warfare is based on, you know, a lot of it's just how you feel about lives. You know, a general doesn't like to send people to their death for sure. Uh-huh. You know, young men. And now you've probably seen some of those videos from Ukraine where they're dropping mortar rounds on. I mean, it's just, oh man.
Yeah, that's so rough. And I think also something like touching on that is like, it's kind of sketchy to me, like AI and warfare, because you look at different countries and they have different military doctrine, right? Like, for example, we've seen Russia is typically more willing to, like in an invasion, lose more of their troops, per se, in certain maneuvers. And there's just different countries that have like a different value. And if they're training their own AI models, integrated into war, it just like, I don't know, to me, it just feels kind of gross. But I mean, even for you, I mean, this is probably something you've thought a lot about, right? We have really big AI being integrated into weapons with like Palantir, for example, or even right, one of your previous co-founders, Palmer, right? He's working on Anduril, yeah. Right? And I'm sure like he has some, I've seen just recently he unveiled like a autonomous, you know, drone airplane. That's this stuff is all getting AI Fury. Integrated into it.
Yeah. Fury rather, Yeah. I don't know I can't tell you everything, but I've been approached by the Air Force to help them with stuff. And
right.
I'm like a little bit on the fence on it. The problem with me is that I don't want to have a job right now. Although I would help them, I mean, it's the government.
Yeah.
I don't know to which level in that product that he has AI integrated. He says it's completely autonomous. Uh-huh. Maybe. I mean, that's a lot of hardware to try to get done. He's been working on what, like 6 years? It seems like a lot of stuff to get done in a shorter period of time. I'm always wary of announcements like that. It's like, what does it really do? You know, so, but I don't have a lot of comments on what his stuff it does. I'm skeptical. A lot of things I hear when I hear announcements like that, if it's that good, you don't say anything about it.
It's like, revealing
your stuff to the other Formula One team, you know.
Yeah.
You're telling Red Bull what you're, you know, you just don't say anything, although they probably know. So that's kind of what I think on that issue. You know, one of the things about GTA 5, Grand Theft Auto 5, you know that if you played that, the entire little country that you played in was created entirely in CAD on Autodesk by people.
Really?
Yeah, it was.
Wow.
I sit there and draws that in CAD. And I think it would be cool to be able to say to an AI engine, make a building with broken windows and graffiti on it, make it out of brick, make it 10 stories, and make smoke coming out of the top. And it just does the whole thing, including the shading and texturing for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I just saw a tool that's like that. It does 3D worlds based off of AI. And it's so interesting because it's got a little chatbot like ChatGPT where it's like, you tell it what to do, it builds the world, and you're like, okay, make the building taller. Okay, actually make a moat around it. Okay, like, and so it's like live editing. So fascinating. This is going to get into, this is going to get into like Oculus integrating this into Horizon Worlds and other things like that. I can't help but think it'll be so fascinating.
That's the best utility because the labor that goes in it. Also, you can have the game generate its own cities, each one very different from the other.
Yeah.
You know, as you go along and you play, it just automatically, based on text script, the new structure, the new building that you run into, or, you know, that's just, I think that's cool. And,
yeah.
You know, create monsters and tanks and all kinds of stuff. Midjourney, I mean, some of the stuff that's been done is, like I said, it's hellish.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you ask me, that's the best utility
best
for AI.
Use case.
For strategy, it has to be designed, you know, it's designed on a storyboard. Like you tell the story of how it's like a movie. You tell the story of how the game is to unfold and how it's to play.
Yeah.
To the producer, you know, this is what the people that come up with the game idea, that basically it's like a sketch type thing. Granted, I haven't been around the area in 10 years, but that's basically how it's done it. And I go to it like the E3 or GDC or something, you see people doing a pitch, right? And so this strategy is designed by a human being for entertainment. Can AI design the game strategy? It would have to be based on previous strategies and what worked well. but certainly mm-hmm. I think it could, you know, so it would be cool to have an AI engine generate an entire game. You could be a developer sitting in your house and say, and you just make an entire game just by doing descriptives. You know?
Yeah. So fascinating. I think that's going to be a massive part of it, is just this whole personalized angle.
Movies, for entertainment.
Yeah. You can direct your own movie. You pick the actors that are in it. You pick like the script and the storyline. Like, come on, that's crazy.
That's a really, really good application. It could be its own industry, and you put them up on Netflix or something like that.
Yeah. And I mean, even people worrying that like AI replaces, like those actors can get a royalty every time they're included in a certain movie. And maybe they have like personal moral things where like, I don't do war movies, or I don't do, like they could like pick their criteria, but you can just kind of mix and match and build. I think that would be a powerful use case. Like movies, music. I mean, I've already heard some incredible Johnny Cash AI songs that I was pretty blown away by. So yeah, I think there's so many incredible applications. Well, Jack, thank you so much for coming on the AI Chat podcast today. I know this thing went way over. I'm sorry. I was just getting too many incredible insights from you. But if people are interested in reaching out to you and finding more about what you're working on or anything else, what's the best way for them to get in contact with you or see some of the things you're doing?
Probably through my assistant. The problem with me is I don't answer my emails. I see them go by and I go, I'll get to that. And I never do. So she filters that stuff, not filters, but she like bugs me and I don't answer stuff. It's like what happened with you. So that's the best way. And also LinkedIn, reach out on LinkedIn. I have someone help me with that. So it's been a great talk, and you're really good at this. I was pretty impressed. So thank you.
Well, it's been amazing. To the listeners, thank you so much for tuning into the AI Chat podcast. Make sure to rate us wherever you get your podcasts, and have an amazing rest of your day.